From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump says he's skipping the next presidential debate. The news came early this morning after the debate commission announced that the town hall event would be all virtual because of COVID-19, which the president is infected with. That means that last night's vice presidential debate may be the last debate of the year. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith joins us now. Tam, Trump's campaign manager, Bill Stepien, who, by the way, is also infected with coronavirus, said the president will hold a rally instead of debating Biden. But Trump just got out of the hospital. Is he going to be able to leave the White House?
Well, he says he feels great. He, in a call with Fox Business News, also said he doesn't think he's contagious anymore. But they have not provided, the White House has not provided any details about how they're going to certify that he's not contagious anymore. Stepien, in his statement, suggested that by the time of the debate next week, President Trump would have numerous negative COVID tests. And so that's how they would certify it. But we haven't gotten any word from the White House on that.
And what about the Biden campaign? Have they responded to the news that Trump wants to pull out of the debate?
They have, in fact, just recently. And what they're saying is that if President Trump doesn't want to do the debate virtually, then Joe Biden will find a way to take questions from the American people in some other venue. And they are suggesting that the October 22nd debate, the last debate, then become a town hall style debate. Unclear where this goes. A White House official in a different Fox interview had said that he thought that maybe this was just the opening of negotiations about the terms of a potential debate. Previously, the Trump campaign had said that they'd be open to doing it outdoors, seemingly acknowledging that the president has coronavirus.
Right. Although that Amy Coney Barrett announcement was also outdoors, and it sounds like that may have been a super spreader event just all by itself. Now, is there a risk?
Jeremy, let me just add that there was a private reception that was indoors where people also weren't wearing masks.
Right. Right.
And there was debate prep indoors without masks.
Exactly. And we're not exactly sure where the outbreak happened. Is it a risk for President Trump to not show up for a debate given that he's down in the polls?
Right. He's down in the polls. He is solidly and in a very stable way down in the polls. He needs to do something to shake up this race and change the trajectory in a good direction for himself. And the last debate didn't do that. The last debate seemed to actually hurt him. So it's not clear why he would not want to do the next debate, though he did raise a concern that if it were virtual, they'd have the ability to cut off his mic. And a big part of his strategy in the first debate was to interrupt, 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 never stop talking.
Let's talk about last night's VP debate. Let's listen to some tape here. Senator Harris laid into the vice president about his leadership on the coronavirus task force. Listen.
The American people have had to sacrifice far too much because of the incompetence of this administration. It is asking too much of the people.
Susan, we talked about
it. It is asking too much of the people.
And then Pence defended the pandemic response and pointed fingers at Biden's handling of the 2009 swine flu epidemic.
When Joe Biden was vice president of the United States, not 7.5 million people contracted the swine flu. 60 million Americans contracted the swine flu.
Tam, did anything fundamentally change the state of the race from that debate last night?
No, it's a vice presidential debate, and they both put in solid performances. Pence is a very good debater. But nobody cares. And by 8 o'clock in the morning, President Trump had called into Fox and was making news and completely overtaking the vice presidential debate. In terms of fact checking those two clips that you played, the numbers are basically right from Pence about the number of people who contracted the swine flu in the U.S. The thing is, swine flu just wasn't nearly as deadly as the coronavirus. And so, sort of heroic efforts were not needed to prevent the spread. So far, more than 211,000 Americans have been killed by the coronavirus. As for the swine flu, a retrospective study that looked at excess deaths in that year found that approximately 12,000 people were killed by it.
Mm-hmm. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Tam, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, last night, the candidates were also asked about election integrity, and Vice President Pence said this.
President Trump and I are fighting every day in courthouses to prevent Joe Biden and Kamala Harris from changing the rules and creating this universal mail-in voting that will create a massive opportunity for voter fraud.
A frequent target of the administration's criticism of voting by mail is California, which this week mailed ballots to more than 20 million registered voters in the state for the first time ever. And with us to talk about this is California Secretary of State Alex Padilla. He's a Democrat. And Secretary Padilla, earlier this year, Governor Gavin Newsom issued a statewide order aiming to make it easy for every registered voter in California to vote by mail. How have you all prepared for the huge volume of mail-in votes you're probably starting to see come in right now?
Well, on the one hand, it is a big volume and a lot of logistics involved, but vote by mail is nothing new in the state of California. In fact, in our March primary, more than 70% of ballots cast, and it was a record turnout, were vote by mail ballots. So we did make the decision to go ahead and expand that to every active registered voter in California, given the COVID-19 pandemic. But we're not starting from scratch here. But nonetheless, it is a lift for each county. We've been working for months to make sure they have the equipment they need, the staffing they need, the training they need to offer this as the first choice for voters to cast their ballot and protect their health while also managing as many safe in-person opportunities to vote as possible.
Well, as you know, President Trump is not in favor of sending ballots to all registered voters. He told Fox News back in August that, quote, people that have been dead for 25 years are getting them. What is your response to the president and others who believe that mailing out tens of millions of ballots will lead to widespread voter fraud?
Look, voters deserve to know the truth in terms of how they can register and how they can vote, and truth when it comes to the integrity of the elections and vote by mail especially. The fact of the matter is voter fraud is exceedingly rare. Let me just share a couple of the safeguards that are in place that protect the integrity of vote by mail. Number one, you may not even think about it, but the ballot itself, it's not just any old piece of paper. Each county selects specific paper types with watermarks and other distinguishing features to prevent against counterfeit ballots being introduced into the system. We know that's one of the conspiracy theories that's floating out there, but we have measures to protect against that. The required signature, the first thing county officials do when those ballots come in is compare the signature on the envelope with the signature on file for that person's voter registration record to confirm the identity of the voter. So a lot more to it than just that. We stand by the integrity of a vote by mail. And frankly, during the COVID-19 pandemic, it's arguably the safest way for you to exercise your right to vote and protect your health.
Well, some ballots have been sent out in error, though. About 2,100 voters in the Los Angeles area received ballots with no option to vote for the president of the United States. Of course, the LA County Register's office said they're investigating what they call a printing error. But does that give you any pause about the integrity of mail-in voting in this election?
I'll be honest, whether it's misinformation coming from the Oval Office or printing errors by Los Angeles County, does it add to frustration and workload? Of course. The good thing is there's measures in place to mitigate the impact of errors like that. You know, to their credit, Los Angeles County immediately took responsibility for the error, notified the impacted voters in that one precinct, canceled the ballots that had been issued, immediately reprinted, reissued, correct ballots, and sent them out first class mail. Again, not ideal, not smooth, but measures in place to mitigate against some unforeseen errors like we saw a couple of days ago.
You know, though, even if you and other elections experts have confidence in voting by mail, do you worry about public perception? And I say this because there was this recent UC Berkeley poll that found that more than 40% of likely California voters don't believe that ballots can be delivered safely and on time by the U.S. Postal Service. What's your response to people who think their ballot will get lost in the mail or won't make it on time to be counted?
Yeah, so that 41% figure, it is concerning. Unfortunately, not surprising, given the relentless attacks on the integrity of elections and vote by mail, specifically coming from the national political environment. And I will leave it at that. In terms of how voters can rest assured, a couple of items. One, we have a ballot tracking tool available in California to all voters. Voters can go to vote.ca.gov, click on Where's My Ballot, and subscribe to receive automated messages by email, by text, or phone call on the status of their ballot through the delivery process. The other thing is voters have multiple options for how to return their ballot. I still think the Postal Service is a reliable way, but if voters prefer, in California, they can deliver their ballot to any ballot drop box in their county convenient to them between now and Election Day, and there's a lot of them in each county. Or they can choose to walk it in person and drop it off at any in-person voting location, either on Election Day or during the in-person early voting period. So I think USPS is still going to be a reliable way to do it, but if you're a little hesitant, you have other options.
That's California Secretary of State Alex Padilla. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, and please continue to stay safe.
Joe Biden and Mike Pence are both campaigning today in Arizona, a state that could be critical for the outcome of the presidential election. Arizona also might decide which party controls the U.S. Senate. The incumbent Republican Senator Martha McSally is trailing her Democratic opponent Mark Kelly in the polls and in fundraising. That could mean a difficult road ahead for President Trump and the Republican Party in a traditionally conservative state. Here in Now's Peter O'Dowd is based in Phoenix, Arizona, and that's where he joins us from for the latest in our Senate Tracker series. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's talk about the candidates here, starting with the Republican Martha McSally, who was appointed to the Senate after John McCain died in 2018. Tell us more about Senator McSally and her record.
Well, before she was a senator, Martha McSally was a congresswoman who represented a district in southern Arizona. And I think for years you could say that she was actually a pretty moderate voice, especially on issues like immigration. And, you know, even now she'll point out that she's ranked the sixth most bipartisan lawmaker in the Senate. But no doubt over the last few years in the Trump era, she's taken a hard turn to the right. She even sounds like President Trump these days on the campaign trail. In a recent debate this week, she started calling Mark Kelly Counterfeit Kelly, a very Trumpian nickname. And she's trying really hard to make Kelly appear to be tied to the radical left, just like the Trump campaign is doing with Joe Biden. That said, I think it's also important to point out her personal story, which is a key to her image in this campaign. Martha McSally served in Iraq and Afghanistan. She was the first woman in U.S. history to fly a fighter jet in combat and to command a fighter squadron. And Jeremy, I don't know if you remember this, she took a very courageous step in a committee hearing admitting that she was raped by a superior officer in the Air Force. So Martha McSally says that she's a fighter, and I think it's pretty hard to disagree with that.
Well, and her opponent has quite the personal story as well. Mark Kelly is a former NASA astronaut married to Gabrielle Giffords, who, of course, has been recovering for years from being shot in Arizona. Mark Kelly has never held public office. And at the candidate's first and only debate this week, he criticized the Trump administration's handling of the pandemic.
We've got a serious crisis on our hands. We've got a public health crisis, which spurred an economic crisis. And both of these things have been made worse by a crisis of leadership. You know, over and over again, we have been a step behind.
Tell us more about Mark Kelly and what his campaign strategy is all about.
Yeah, in some ways, you have to feel kind of bad for Martha McSally, because it's hard to stand out as a fighter pilot politician when you're running against another person who flew combat missions for the Navy, but who also was a NASA pilot for the shuttle missions to space. But that's really not even why he's famous here. As you said, he is best known as husband to Gabby Giffords. After she was shot, the couple formed this group that called for tighter gun control measures, things like universal background checks. And I think this is really where you get the sense of Mark Kelly as the politician. He's got to do what other Democrats like Senator Kyrsten Sinema have had to do in the state to get elected, which is to toe a very moderate line. So he may be famous for his work on gun measures, but he's also got to say to voters that he's a proud gun owner and that he has no intentions of taking anyone's guns away. So if he is to win in Arizona, he can't get dragged down into debates that make him look like he's a deep blue Democrat.
The issue of health care also came up at that debate. Here's what McSally had to say.
Republicans and Democrats can agree on a couple things related to health care. First is we will always protect pre-existing conditions. There's nobody who disagrees with that. The second is that Obamacare is failing. It's not working. And so what I'm doing is fighting for more options for people.
McSally has voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which, of course, protects pre-existing conditions. What is each candidate offering on health care in this race?
Yeah, you know, Jeremy, I've spoken with both Democrats and Republicans in this state who say this race has been very, very low on policy, generally speaking. But if there is one issue that comes up a lot, it's healthcare, especially in Arizona, because, of course, the state had one of the worst COVID outbreaks in the world just a few months ago. So as you heard, Martha McSally promises to protect pre-existing conditions despite her votes to undermine or repeal the Affordable Care Act. She says that Mark Kelly in the Senate will mean the end of private insurance, the end of Medicare as we know it. On the other hand, Mark Kelly, again, trying to toe a moderate line here, says he supports a public option to compete with private insurance, but says he has no intention of taking away private plans if you want them.
So when you look at all the Senate races that are kind of up for grabs this time around, it seems like this is the one that the Democrats are most confident about. Why is that? Why is McSally trailing in pretty much all the polls?
Right. It's not even that she's trailing. It's that she's trailing by a lot in some cases. The New York Times Siena poll this week showed her down by 11 points. So she's been looking up at Kelly the entire time. And I think a big reason is demographics. The same demographic trends that are threatening to turn Arizona blue in the presidential race are also affecting the Senate race. So people are moving from more liberal, expensive states like California. The number of young Latinos and immigrants voting for the first time in Arizona is growing really, really fast. But at the same time, McSally is actually doing worse than Trump in a lot of the polls. And one theory is that she was never elected. You know, just a few weeks after she lost that race to Kyrsten Sinema in 2018, she was appointed to this Senate seat. And so she started the job with a lot of people thinking like that she had been rewarded for losing an election. And then one other thing I'll say is that John McCain is really still a beloved figure in Arizona, Jeremy. And while she's spoken well of him in the past, she got a lot of heat for not defending John McCain more when President Trump was railing against him. And McCain's widow, Cindy McCain, has endorsed Joe Biden and at the same time has said she has no interest in supporting Martha McSally.
Here now is Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix as we continue our Senate Tracker series looking at Senate races around the country. We'll have another one for you next week. Peter, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, the American poet Louise Glück won the Nobel Prize for Literature today. The Swedish Academy praised her unmistakable poetic voice that with austere beauty makes individual existence universal. Glück was Poet Laureate of the United States from 2003 to 2004 and has won a number of awards, including a Pulitzer Prize, a National Book Award, and she was awarded the 2015 National Humanities Medal by President Obama. Joining us now is NPR Arts Editor Rose Friedman. And Rose, first, just tell us more about Louise Glück.
Yeah, so if you're a poetry fan in this country, chances are you've heard her name before. She's one of our most decorated poets, as you said. She's won all those awards. She's really beloved among poetry readers. I should say this is a bit of a surprise that an American won so soon after Bob Dylan got the prize in 2016. And for the folks at Ladbrokes who keep the betting odds, she was never at the top of the list. But I think a lot of her fans will be really gratified to hear this news today.
Well, and tell us a little bit about her poetry. What is her work known for?
In the announcement, the Swedish Academy called her a poet who is always striving for clarity. She's really known for paring down language to just the essentials. She's often quite biting. In terms of subject matter, she writes a lot about her childhood, her parents and family, and then about having a family of her own. A lot of her work is related to the fragility of having a body. She had anorexia as a teenager, and she had a sister who died before she was born. So she's very aware of the possibility of death. She also incorporates a lot of classical themes and other myths into her work. She's written from the point of view of flowers. And we have a little bit of tape from her reading from her poem, Telescope, at the Lannan Foundation in 2016.
Telescope. There is a moment after you move your eye away when you forget where you are because you've been living, it seems, somewhere else in the silence of the night sky. You've stopped being here in the world. You're in a different place, a place where human life has no meaning. You're not a creature in a body. You exist as the stars exist, participating in their stillness, their immensity. Then you're in the world again, at night on a cold hill, taking the telescope apart. You realize afterward not that the image is false, but the relation is false. You see again how far away each thing is from every other thing.
Louise Glick reading from her poem, Telescope. Rose, this is the first time an American woman has won the Nobel Prize in Literature since Toni Morrison in 1993, and the last few years of the Nobel Prize in Literature have been controversial. Can you catch us up to speed a little bit, and how will Glick's win be seen in that context?
Sure. So a few years ago, there was a scandal in the committee that awards the Nobel for Literature, which involved both sexual abuse and leaking the winners' names. So it started with the husband of a committee member, but it really wound up engulfing the whole committee. So in 2018, they didn't award a prize. They took the year to regroup. They got rid of a few members. They added a few new ones. And then last year, they awarded two prizes, and one of those picks turned out to be really controversial. Peter Hanke, he's an Austrian novelist who was a supporter of Serbia during the conflict there and has been accused of really being an apologist for war crimes. So in that sense, Louise Glick was probably a safer pick. She's a popular poet. She writes about subjects that are a little bit more personal. But definitely her readers would tell you she's a really daring and sometimes brutally honest writer. So definitely not a boring choice at all.
That is NPR's Rose Friedman talking about this year's Nobel Prize in Literature going to American Louise Glick. Rose, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
As news organizations scramble to cover the presidential campaign under extraordinary conditions, they're also looking with apprehension to election night itself. Close margins in key states could fuel uncertainty. Mail-in ballots may take a while to count, and the president has said he may not accept the results if he loses. NPR's David Folkenflik takes a look at CBS News, where seasoned journalists are preparing for the challenge.
Here's a list of just some of the issues defining the news agenda right now. The health threat from COVID-19, the recession and unemployment, the push for racial justice, the fires out west, the Supreme Court.
The only thing we're missing are the locusts.
That's CBS News President Susan Zirinsky.
So there isn't a person in this country that hasn't experienced one piece of this complicated puzzle. It makes this election more poignant, more important.
Here's what 2020 looks like. CBS has felt compelled to assign veteran reporters to two completely new beats. Major Garrett is now covering the vote itself, concerns about voter suppression, how mailing in ballots works, what's changed thanks to COVID-19. Jeff Pegues, who covers the Justice Department and Homeland Security, he's now leading CBS's team on misinformation. Pegues wrote a book called Kompromat about the role of the Russians in the 2016 elections. They sowed division and fostered false stories and claims to try to disrupt the election and to aid President Trump.
We really didn't find that out until the end of that election, how different it was. But now we know going into this what could happen.
And here's the delicate truth. The foreign actors aren't the only ones spreading misinformation. The president himself has made a series of false claims, especially about the elections themselves.
Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transfer of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
His claims of widespread voter fraud, there's no evidence to support them. Social media platforms can block or flag such false claims, but journalists, they can't pretend they're not out there. The president has said if he loses, it would be a result of fraud, and that raises the stakes for journalists covering the race. Nora O'Donnell is the anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News.
We may be able to have a sense by the end of the 7 o'clock hour which way this election is heading. But none of us, you know, has ruled out the possibility that this is an election that could take several days or a week or longer.
O'Donnell says the network will stick to the facts, whatever Trump or anyone else claims on election night.
We are trying to prepare our viewers for what could be a drawn out election night process. And that means having some patience and knowing that we may not have the results on election night or may not be able to predict a winner on election night. We want to convey a sense of patience and also convey a sense of transparency, that this is what we know, that it does not mean that there's fraud or that the election is rigged.
Susan Zirinsky, the CBS News chief, acknowledges the mistakes that the press has made on previous election nights, especially in 2000 and 2016. The network has invested in layer upon layer of voter surveys and counting.
We are careful. We are not timid. We are careful. And that's a distinction.
Zirinsky says she has faith, faith in the utility of journalism, faith in the viewers, faith in the voters, to hear and see facts for what they are. A faith that will be put to the test if the president decides to use his bully pulpit once more on election night to drown out the media's microphones. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
The city of Louisville has released the most comprehensive report to date from the police investigation into the shooting death of Breonna Taylor. She was shot and killed by police inside of her apartment nearly 7 months ago. One of the officers involved with the shooting has been indicted with endangering the lives of Taylor's neighbors, but no one has been charged with her death. For more on what's in this report, we have Amina Alahi, a reporter at WFPL in Louisville, who's been following this story. Welcome back.
Thank you.
These documents are coming less than a week after Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron published the recording of grand jury proceedings. Why are these new files being made public, and why are they important?
Well, these files are compiled by the police department, which is, of course, a public agency. And they're important because they show us how the police investigated themselves when it came to this shooting, which has, as you know, captured the attention of the nation and was, in fact, a topic of the vice presidential debate last night. So what's important about these is that we're able to see what sort of evidence they collected, what sorts of statements they gave immediately after the incident, what they collected over time, body camera footage that wasn't previously released, and just a lot of materials that go even beyond what the attorney general seems to have presented to the grand jury. Those recordings you mentioned, we've been going through them, and they focus on, you know, certain aspects of this incident, but they don't, for example, look at what was used to obtain the warrant for Breonna Taylor's apartment. So we certainly learn more about what police found.
And let's talk a little bit more about that. This release also includes interviews with the officers involved, including one who said that after the police broke down Taylor's door, they were met with, quote, a volley of bullets. That's very different from what we know actually happened, correct?
Yeah. So just to take you back to what happened that night, police arrived at Breonna Taylor's apartment a little before 1 a.m. on March 13th and knocked on her door. She was at home with her boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, who in a post-incident interview told investigators that he heard the knocking and that she heard the knocking, but they couldn't hear who was on the other side. And that's sort of been the controversy of this no-knock warrant. So when police busted down the door, Kenneth Walker was afraid because he didn't know who it was, and he fired one bullet, he says, at the police officers. Now, you know, in the subsequent reporting and what we've heard publicly through lawsuits and other means, there hasn't been any confirmation that Kenneth Walker ever fired more than a single bullet. And in fact, the evidence that we see in the files released yesterday is that they recovered a single 9mm bullet casing from inside, which seems to match the legally owned weapon that he had. So what this sort of indicates to you is sort of the chaos of the moment, the fact that they didn't expect something like this, that, you know, in fact, they assumed that she might be at home alone. And it just goes to show how differently people interpreted what was happening that night.
And you referenced this, but there are also questions about the warrant itself. How much do we know from this report and other documents about how police obtained that no-knock warrant for Taylor's apartment?
Well, the warrant is now going to become a really critical part of this story at this stage, because we knew from the affidavit that was filed by Detective Joshua Janes, you know, in the springtime or, you know, before the raid, that he said that he had gotten information from a U.S. postal inspector that one of the main targets of the drug investigation they were doing was receiving packages that were suspicious at Breonna Taylor's apartment. This was his justification for going to her apartment. He thought they might find drugs or money. Nothing like that was ever found in her apartment. So now what we see, and this has been reported somewhat by local media, but what we see in greater detail is that not only did he not use the postal inspector to verify that information, the postal inspector said there was no such suspicious package ever going to her home. And what we're learning now is that the Louisville Metro Police Department has a really sort of tense relationship with the USPS, and that according to the documents that we received yesterday, they don't seem to be willing to work with them directly. So there are a lot of questions, not only about how the warrant was obtained and whether the evidence presented was truthful, but also why a judge signed off on it.
That was Amina Alahi, reporter at WFPL in Louisville. Thank you.
In Colorado, gray wolves are on the ballot this fall. On Election Day, voters will decide whether to reintroduce the endangered species to the state. But at the same time, a wolf pack has made it to Colorado all on its own, which has complicated the ballot fight. Sam Brash from Colorado Public Radio explains.
To start this story, we really need to take a step back to last winter. That's when biologists confirmed six wolves were living in Colorado near the Wyoming border. Lone wolves had wandered into the state before, usually from the area around Yellowstone National Park. But this was the first pack since the 1930s or 40s. Rebecca Farrell is a spokesperson with Colorado State Wildlife Agency.
We know, based on the scat samples, DNA that were taken this winter, that we have sibling relationships. And so what that tells us is that there's a breeding pair that has put forth, you know, these siblings, at least at some point in the past few years.
And if mom and dad are, in fact, still breeding, they'll probably do it again here in Colorado.
They mate just for life, really. They have long-term relationships.
All of which raises a big question about the upcoming ballot initiative. It would direct the state to put paws on the ground by the end of 2023. But the campaign against reintroduction sees hope in the recently arrived pack. Sean Martini is with Rethink Wolves, the main opposition group.
If it happens naturally, it's something we have to live with. But why try and force nature's hand through an initiative process? That seems silly.
Recently, Colorado biologists have been doing something pretty strange to try to find evidence of wolf breeding. They step out of their trucks, face different directions, and howl, listening for a response sort of like this. That's a group of howling wolf pups. If biologists hear those sounds, they can theoretically find dens and maybe confirm wolves are breeding. Biologists think they've heard puppy howls a few times, but they haven't confirmed a litter. Right now, the only evidence is one sighting of one puppy back in June. Again, spokesperson Rebecca Farrell.
Despite our continuing monitoring efforts in that area, we don't have any photographic evidence or scat to provide additional confirmation at this time.
The evidence isn't just thin. Kevin Crooks is an ecologist at Colorado State University, and he says even if there are puppies, there's no guarantee wolves will stick around.
Just having a small number of animals, six or seven, would not have a high probability of persistence over the long term.
Biologists refer to this as viability. A population can only survive if there are enough individuals spread out over a big enough area to persist over the long term. By that definition, Crook says Colorado's small wolf population remains at risk.
It is true that if wolves were reintroduced, that would increase the probability that wolves would fully recover to form a self-sustaining population.
Meanwhile, there are new concerns about Colorado's pioneer pack. Mike Phillips is a biologist who helped lead wolf restoration in Yellowstone. He's now backing the ballot plan in Colorado. And last month, he received a short, anonymous letter.
That read simply, at least three wolves have been shot from the pack in Colorado. Multiple agencies know, and I thought you should know as well.
Colorado Parks and Wildlife later confirmed the claims. According to the agency, a hunter told them about killing wolves just across the border in Wyoming. There's a good chance those animals came from the pack seen in Colorado. And if you're wondering if that's legal, the answer is basically, yeah.
Maybe not right, but legal because the state has decided across nearly 88% of the Wyoming, the gray wolf is treated as a predatory species. It can be killed in any numbers at any time, day or night, any time of the year, and left in the field.
But wolves are still protected under the Endangered Species Act in Colorado. Phillip says that legal geography is why it's so unlikely wolves will recolonize the state on their own.
It's not complicated, pal. If Coloradans aspire to have gray wolves as part of the state's future to help restore the balance, they need to reintroduce those wolves.
And that decision doesn't rest with scientists or wildlife officials. It's squarely in the hands of Colorado voters. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Brash.
The NFL's coronavirus problem is getting worse. The Tennessee Titans and the New England Patriots canceled practice today after more players tested positive. Those two teams have already had games postponed, and the new cases raise questions about their games this weekend. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Well, how is the league handling this? Because it seems like it could be getting beyond their control.
Yes. So you're right. Both of those teams have had games postponed. But with the in the Patriots case, it was only by one day. The Titans have already had their bye week forced upon them. And that creates a lot of scheduling if they have to have another bye week and the NFL teams only have one. Then there's the cascading effect of how this might affect the schedule. Maybe the NFL would have to add an extra week to accommodate all the play that would have to be all the teams and all the games that would have to be played. But also there is intimations from the league office that an extremely harsh punishment could come down on the Titans, because whereas the Patriots have had two great players afflicted by COVID, it doesn't seem, it's not documented, they did anything wrong. But the Titans allegedly practiced not in the team facility, but privately, and were told explicitly not to by the league. So people are talking about, well, they're talking about a lot of punishments. We don't know what it will be. It seems like the Titans did not play this well.
You know, Mike, we've been talking to you week after week, and we've spent a lot of the time talking about coronavirus and what's been going on there. Maybe we have lost sight of what is actually happening on the field or on the court, because there have been some tremendous performances. Let's start with the Seattle Storm winning their fourth WNBA title this week.
Yeah, that's a good one to talk about if you talk about tremendous performances. Breonna Stewart is one of the greatest players in the WNBA. So 3 years ago, she wins the finals MVP as the Storm wins the title. Last year, she's out for the entire season with an Achilles. It's a tough injury to come back from. How does she come back? She did the same thing this year that she did in 2018. She wins the finals MVP. She scores 26 points in the finals game, and the Storm wins its fourth WNBA title.
And what about in the NBA? It looks like LeBron James is about to lead the LA Lakers to the championship. They're up 3-1 over the Miami Heat. Game 5 is tomorrow night. What would that mean? Another Lakers title and another title for James?
Yeah, for the Lakers, it would be, I guess they'd say, on brand. Their fans would, infuriating all the other fans in the NBA. For James, it's just amazing, because he would be the third player to win a franchise, an NBA title with three different franchises. The other two, John Sally and Robert Horry, are good. They're not going to sniff the Hall of Fame. LeBron James, you know, very much in the discussion for greatest player of all time. If you look at how James has changed his game, you know, he led the NBA in assists this year. He's a forward. The next, I don't know, 10, 12 guys on the list are guards. Guards are supposed to hand out the assists. But James does what it takes to win, and especially with the Heat injured, looks like the Lakers are going to win that title.
Let's talk about baseball. Listen to this performance from last night.
This is ball to deep center field. Ballinger twisting around. Still going. He's at the wall.
He made the catch, just an incredible catch by Dodgers outfielder Cody Bellinger. There weren't any fans in the stadium to see it, but it sure sounds like they were with the fake crowd noise we just heard. They really got it right, didn't they?
Yes, kudos to the audio engineer, but also to Cody Bellinger. So the situation, this was a tight game. The Padres were down by one, but with a man on, Fernando Tatis comes up in the seventh inning, and he's facing the hardest thrower in the major leagues. The Dodgers pitcher is He throws 99. Bruce Starr, Gratterall throws 99 or 100 on every pitch. 99 mile an hour fastball. Tatis takes him. It looks like he takes him yard center field. And there goes Bellinger with this amazing catch. And they need it because San Diego winds up loading the bases in the bottom of the ninth, down one. The Dodgers eke out a victory. Every game in the Major League Baseball playoffs is now an elimination game. They're in a best of five series, and every team has every series has a team with two wins. So it's really getting exciting in baseball.
Mike, does this mean you were watching that and not the vice presidential debate last night?
Well, the timing was such that I could catch both. And you know what? There were flies in each of them.
Okay. Real quick, anything else jumping out at you from the baseball playoffs?
Yes. Like I said, this is an exciting time because this is a best of five series. Atlanta is up on Miami. The Yankees, Giancarlo Stanton, has hit home runs five games in a row, but Tampa Bay has won the last two games. So, you know, if we talk again tomorrow, every single one of these series could be done and we'll know who the final four teams in baseball are.
We have to give Mike credit for his quickness. There were flies in each of them. That was right off the cuff. Good for you, Mike. Mike Pesca, here now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.